Strange, Punks and Drunks and Flicks and Kicks, written and read by Richard Strange, episode 38. 2 weeks after Diana's funeral, Kathy Acker announced that she had sold her flat in Islington and was leaving London to return to the States. She'd become increasingly ill over the summer, but had blamed her illness on drinking contaminated canal water. It somehow seemed unlikely to us, but she was adamant that we thought that this was her way of dealing with her gradual physical deterioration. Relying on faith healers and other alternative medical treatments, she convinced herself that she was indeed cured of cancer, even after an Appalachian faith healer informed her the previous year that you have cancer all over your body. I see a huge black leech in the center of your heart. Wanting to be free of cancer, Acker relied exclusively on advice from her healers and had discontinued regular conventional medical checkups. A few of us arranged to meet her for a farewell drink at her Islington flat the night before she left. Me, Reen, Louisa, and the Turner Prize-nominated artist Cathy DeMoncho, whose catalogue Cathy had written the introduction for, all arrived to find her sitting in an empty room, surrounded by towers of cardboard boxes, into which she'd packed her whole life, including her travelling library of 4,000 or 5,000 books, waiting for repatriation. Somehow we all felt a desperate chill and sense of foreboding in that room as we sipped wine from plastic cups and tried to keep each other's spirits up. Beneath the joshing and the reminiscing and the promises to stay in constant touch, we somehow all knew that Kathy was returning home to die, with the unfathomable instinct of a wounded animal needing to return to its birthplace. She told us she was heading to California to drop her things, then crossing the border into Tijuana, Mexico, where there was a radical new cancer treatment being practiced, so new that it didn't even have clearance to be licensed in the USA yet. She was going to give it a shot. We hugged her and kissed her and told her to try and get lots of rest and promised we'd all meet up again. In truth, we knew that we would never see her again. Autumn was the time of saying goodbyes, as in October, Gino and his friend Mark headed out to Australia to play cricket and to seek their fortunes. Gino had taken his A-levels in London and passed all three and had worked for a while at a theatrical PR and marketing company in Soho, but now he wanted to test himself. For Rini it was especially hard, as Gino was still living with her, and for all the conflict that their strong personalities provoked, they were intensely close, and she knew that she would miss him terribly. For me, it was easier, sharing a different sort of bond with him, but the idea of him travelling across the world, albeit at the age of 21, still made me feel a pang of apprehension. I drove Rini and the boys to Gatwick, and as we hovered by the departure gate, making the small talk that you make at those times, eventually it was time for them to go, and all three of us embraced and wept as we parted while Mark hovered at a discreet distance. All the way home, Rini and I, alone in the car, could barely find a word to utter, but tried to exchange the occasional word of comfort and reassurance to each other. I got a commercial job to do for Swedish TV, something about the Swedish football pools, I think, and I had to go to Leeds to shoot it with a Thomas Brolin, an overweight Swedish footballer with a great future behind him. While I was in Leeds, I decided I would try and track down my brother John, who I'd not seen in 20 years. He had performed an extraordinary disappearing act after his divorce, before our father died. He showed none of my hypocrisy by attending the funeral, and was never subsequently in touch, even though the three of us brothers were the sole nominees on the trust which held the family house until Mum's death. I could understand perfectly his reasons for doing what he did. He had decided, I surmised, that he wanted to reinvent himself, to restart his life, and it was not possible to do that effectively while staying in touch with those who he'd known before year zero. We knew that he'd moved north, and while his disappearance was especially hurtful to Mum, who took it hard and personally, I could only sympathise with his course of action. I surprised him with a telephone call to his office, telling him that I was in Leeds and that if he wanted to meet for a drink, I would like that, and if he didn't, I would fully understand and I would never bother him again. I was surprised that he agreed to meet, and we arranged a rendezvous in the neutral surroundings of a bar in a large hotel. We recognised each other immediately, of course, with that uncanny radar that siblings have, which goes way beyond physical recognition, and I ordered a couple of stiff drinks and we sat down. Inevitably, the meeting was at first a mix of forced joviality and guarded formality, but gradually the temperature warmed up and we started to talk more freely. He had changed the way all men change after they're 40, with more weight and less hair than when I'd seen him last, but temperamentally he was still very much the same. Intelligent, serious, but humorous. We moved from the bar to an Italian restaurant and over dinner exchanged a lot of reminiscences about our early lives. I suspected John was as damaged by Dad as I was, bewildered, angry and sad that we'd been denied a normal father, but determined to get over it in a practical rather than in a psychological, emotional way. Like me, he's compensated for our father's lack of sociability by developing a surfeit of it. But I suspect that also like me, there's a part of him that is forever dark, forever black, and forever dissatisfied. I felt glad to have seen him, but drew no conclusions, and we made no promises to keep in touch. We exchanged phone numbers, and I told him that I wouldn't tell Mum that we'd met until and unless he wanted to see her again. I spent that night in Leeds and the next day travelled back to London for the launch of a book called Women Unlimited, which Charlotte Skeen Catlin had worked on. Charlotte was an old girlfriend of Duncan Ward and was now living with Malcolm McLaren, a former architect student and illustrator. She was, by this time, a close friend of ours, and we saw a hell of a lot of each other. The book, a sort of how to do it for women, was a big success, and the party at the Ivy restaurant was a glamorous gathering for the art world, media types and drag queens. At the party I met up with Minnie Weiss, Rachel Weiss's younger sister who had worked on Duncan's film, and we got chatting about music and she said she really wanted to sing. I told her to come over and try out a couple of songs I'd written. Where Rachel is classic and poised, Minnie is kooky and slightly gawky. I wrote a couple of songs for her specifically that week and she came over to try them out. One was called Poisonality Girl and one was called Dumb. Working with her was a slow process for all her enthusiasm. She could either sing in tune, in time or with attitude, but to get her to do all three simultaneously required the patience of Job. What we ended up with was enough to make me think it was worth pursuing the idea, but I knew it was not going to be the quickest way to turn a buck. She loved being in my small studio, singing her heart out and hearing the songs take shape, trying out harmonies and different ways of performing the songs, and she got the greatest kick when she went home with the tape and played it to Rachel, and she said, "That's great." There was a courtroom drama in December that year that once again had all the elements of a Joe Orton farce. Dominic Burning, with whom we'd spent the previous Christmas in Barcelona, was organising a charity exhibition and the sale of work by some children who lived in a township outside Johannesburg. Dominic, a white South African charmer with delicate features and the easy bedside manner required of an art dealer, was doing his bit for the underprivileged, planning to send all the profits back to help the children of the townships. He enlisted the help of two other South Africans who he didn't know particularly well and organised the show and sale to take place at the Humanist Society in Conway Hall, Bloomsbury, in the weeks running up to Christmas. The work was to comprise mainly of toys and animal sculptures made from wire and recycled tin cans. It was charming and very saleable. George Melly had agreed to act as auctioneer and everything was set except that the work hadn't yet arrived. Things were getting very tight when Dominic got a call from the customs and excise people saying that they had impounded the two crates of toys which had just arrived at Heathrow. No amount of questioning from Dominic would get them to give any more details, and in desperation he telephoned Louisa. Louisa's dad was a Conservative MP, Sir Anthony Buck, and Dominic prevailed upon Louisa to get her dad to pull ministerial rank and get the consignment released from Heathrow so that the sale could go ahead and they could set about installing the show at Conway Hall. Louisa phoned her dad, telling him the details and the good cause involved, and Sir Anthony, the White Knight, leapt into action and got on the blower to the customs and excise people. I imagine he said something like, "Now listen here, I want those two crates released immediately, you hear me? Otherwise I'll take this affair up at the highest government level. It's a charity sale, for God's sake, not an international smuggling ring," or something. That afternoon, the two crates were duly dispatched to Dominic, who at the time was living in a Guildford Street squat. With his two co-organisers, he opened first of the crates, and lying on top was a huge Tupperware container. "Thank God that's still here," said one of the colleagues, and peeled back the lid, revealing hundreds of fingers of Durban poison marijuana. Except that the marijuana had been emptied out, leaving only the empty paper tubes. Lifting the plastic container, the accomplice noticed a wire had been attached to it and immediately thought it was a bomb. But it wasn't a bomb. It was a signal to a squad car parked outside, and at precisely that moment, 30 plainclothes drug squad officers battered down Dominic's front door and swarmed all over the squad. They arrested Dominic and his two colleagues for importing marijuana and took them away. Dominic, who genuinely knew nothing about the extra contents of the Ark consignment, was eventually released and returned to his squad to try and salvage the show. He told George what had happened, and George bowed out of the occasion, not wishing to have his name associated with the whole dubious affair. In desperation, Dominic called the toff punk rocker Eddie Temple Tudor and asked him to do the auctioneering. He agreed, and Dominic went about installing the work. Meanwhile, the two South African colleagues had been formally charged with importing cannabis with intent to sell and were languishing in Brixton Prison on remand. They'd been there for 5 days and had been warned to expect a sentence of up to 5 years. Ironically, their court appearance was the same day as the sale, and as they were being transported to the court, they noticed their warder was in a particularly jovial mood. Asked why, he replied that the previous day he'd won the jackpot on a fruit machine, and that morning he had won the staff Christmas raffle. The two prisoners asked the warder to touch them for luck, and he solemnly laid hands on each of their shoulders and mumbled some mumbo-jumbo. At the court, the judge was clearly in a similarly festive mood. Hearing the evidence, he dismissed the case and recommended instead the two defendants be deported within 7 days. They raced from the courtroom as free men and hurried to the Conway Hall. That evening, 2 days before Christmas, the show went ahead, with Eddie's auctioneering skills accompanied by a vast band of Burundi tribal drummers. As each sale reached a climax, the drums would thunder, falling silent only when Eddie's gavel fell, then starting up all over again for the next lot. A large sum of money was raised for the children, and Dominic, clearly shaken by his brush with the law, resolved to only ever work with respectable, bona fide colleagues again.